Hey, this is Gina Grad.
Hi, this is Teresa Strasser.
Hi, everyone. This is Mike Errico.
Hey there. This is Casey Cavalier.
I'm Rocky Rose.
And you are listening to The Jay Franzi Show.
Lucky you.
Welcome to The Jay Franzi Show, a behind-the-curtain look at the entertainment industry with insights you can't pay for and stories you've never heard. Now, here's your host, Jay Franzi.
Well, hey there, and welcome to the show. I am Jay Franzi, and this is your backstage pass to the entertainment industry. This week, we get to talk with a live sound mixer. We get to talk with Bruce Ryder. We'll talk to him about the impact that Dave Nattel had on his career, what it's like being on the road with Five Finger Death Punch, and the role that technology plays in his industry today. Now, Bruce, he's an amazing mixer and he's out with an amazing band, and I can't wait to talk to him about that tonight. So if you would like to join in, comment, or fire off any questions, please head over to jayfranzi.com. Now, let's get started. Bruce, sir, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Jay?
I am doing fantastic, sir. I am so happy to have you here today. I am looking forward to this.
Good to be here.
All right, sir. Well, let's go ahead and get started. I know you're from Illinois, and I'd like to know what kind of impact that Dave Nattel had on your career.
Dave Nattel?
Yes, sir.
Quite a lot. He was one of my first sort of big-time people that I saw and met. I was a stagehand, and he was mixing bands like Yes and Richard Marx. He was continually coming through the arena that I worked as a stagehand at, you know, called the Assembly Hall. It was in Urbana, Illinois, at the University of Illinois. And I would fortunately be assigned to the audio crew, you know, and I would watch him mix, you know, and I just noticed how he was very responsive to the band's needs. And at the Yes show, for example, the singer was not pleased with the amount of bottom end rumbling the stage, you know, and he stopped the show and said, engineer, didn't even call him by his name, just engineer, and, you know, said, turn the bass down. And he just immediately reached over, and I was standing there watching him and listening to him work, you know, and he immediately just calmly turned over and turned the bass down and carried on with the show. And I'd watched other artists' interactions in the past, and when the artist makes a request or says something, the ego gets just bruised, you know, so they're like, oh, but it's you don't understand, there's this and that. I guess the biggest thing he taught me right away was just do what the artist asks.
Right. It's their show.
And we're there to help them connect with their audience. That's our primary function out there as sound mixers.
So do you apply that to your work today?
Absolutely.
I know today you're out with a heavyweight. You're out with Five Finger Death Punch, which is one of my favorite bands. So I'm very jealous of you right now.
They've been a wonderful band to work with. I started with Five Finger Death Punch in 2010.
2010. It's been a long time. So what's that time been like?
Just a steady ride up. My first tours with them, they were selling out 1,000, 2,000 seat clubs. Second tour, they're selling out theaters. Next tour, they're selling out small arenas, half house though. You know, they have the curtains of shame all over the venue, you know, and next tour, they take the curtains away and it just keeps getting bigger. And they keep writing amazing songs and they just have this connection with the audience. You know, I think the whole thing with music is about the connection with the audience, you know, and how music transmits emotions and feelings and stuff, you know, and Ivan, the singer of Five Finger Death Punch, has a really good connection with his audience. He sings things that they can relate to and he's observant of people in the audience and sort of caters to their emotions in a way with his performance. You know, it's interesting being sort of the middleman with that, helping them get their point across.
Well, for you, that's got to be, quite a thing for you to take what they're feeling on stage and what they're trying to deliver and then be able to manipulate it to create that for the audience. Mm-hmm. So how does that make you feel when you're able to do that?
It's amazing, you know, and there's magic moments with this band, you know, where, I mean, with a lot of bands have these experiences with their audience, I'm sure. There was one young lady who had cancer, for example, and she was a fan of the band, and Ivan took notice of her and made her feel special, and over multiple shows, including, you know, right before she passed, it's one of the last things she did was got on stage, and I think everyone in the entire room felt emotions and had a little tear, you know, dripping out of the corner of their eye, no matter how tough they want to be as a Five Finger Death Punch fan.
Might be a metal show, but we're not afraid to shed a tear.
Yeah, you know, and he has just a way of communicating like that.
Well, I know he's known for bringing people up on the stage all the time. And
yeah.
So he's got a way with the audience to make them feel like they're part of the show and they're included. And he does. He makes them feel special.
Yeah.
What has been the biggest change that you've seen over that period of time?
Just the popularity of the band just continues to increase. And, you know, they're not like a major label band with major label pushing or whatever. They're a major band, but they do it themselves. You know, the leader of the band is, you know, Zoltan Bathory, the guitarist, and he's really the visionary of the whole thing. And he's put all of these elements in place to make this even possible.
Well, what's it like working with him?
Amazing. We became friends before I started working with them and joined martial arts, and he's a martial arts enthusiast, and that got us talking at first. You know, I was working with a band called Dragon Force, and we were on the Mayhem tour, you know, and we would be practicing our stuff in the morning when it was still cool. It was an outdoor amphitheater tour, so you're basically in a different amphitheater every couple of days doing a show throughout the summer. So it's really hot. And there was a Jägermeister was one of the sponsors, and they had this air-conditioned tent. It was free until, you know, noon or something like that when doors opened. So we'd get together and practice in there. And Zoltan, the guitarist, was invited one day, and he was a judo black belt. And it was great to add to our practice club. And he started hanging out and watching the show and realized that we had a good thing going with the sound. You know, the kick drums weren't overpowering the guitars. You know, the vocals weren't either inaudible or entirely too loud or whatever, you know, just it was nice and balanced. And he took notice of that. And over the next couple of years, we kept in contact and, you know, trying to work out how I could work with them. And this was in 2007 that we met and started developing the relationship. And
that was very early
2010.
On.
Yeah, they were like one of their very first shows was opening up for Dragon Force, actually. And I had not met him on this day. I'd only seen him around. He was just the opening band's guitar player, as far as I knew. And they were a good band. They came in and did their show and didn't really think much of it. You know, it was a favor. They were an add-on to the bill, so it was a favor from people in offices to other people in offices. Early 2007, I suppose. Maybe 2006. I don't remember the exact date. But they've been through a few lineup changes, and each time they make a change, they come back stronger somehow. You know, they have more to prove, and they had an original guitarist, I suppose, when they first were writing. I wasn't with them on that first record. I started with them when they had just released their second album. They had a guitarist, Daryl Roberts was the guitarist, and then separated ways, and Jason Hook became the guitarist, and they moved on to do different projects, and now we have Andy James as the guitarist, and he's just incredible.
Right.
He's got this really clear style of playing where you can just hear every note articulated, and just it's amazing listening to.
Well, I know Jason Hook played a big part in the band, and
yeah,
he has a very distinct sound to him, and he's just an amazing player as well. And people were a little nervous when he left and Andy came in. So you feel like things are going well and he's being well received?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the fans of Five Finger Death Punch, there was, you know, it was seamless. You know, it's great.
All right. Well, let's get back to you and in your role, because to me, you've got probably the most important role in the facility at that time, because you can make or break that show no matter how good or poor the performance is. So can you just start by telling us what a day in the life is like on the road?
Well, a typical day with Five Finger Death Punch. We, on this upcoming tour, for example, we're doing a tour of Europe, and the crew will be on buses. You know, so we'll wake up at the venue for a festival show where we're headlining. Load in will, for us, will be at like 7 a.m. so we can be done sound checking and everything before like, say, 11 a.m. or noon or something, so that the other bands can play. Yeah. So there's, it's wonderful being the headliner, you know, because you get to actually sound check and listen to the PA and EQ things and walk around. And but it happens really early in the morning. Yeah. So you have to make sure you go to sleep on the bus the night before and get good rest and drink plenty of water and eat your vitamins. And yeah, that's a typical, you know, beginning of a festival day. We'll set our consoles and everything in place, and the backline guys will be setting up all of the instruments, the lighting team and set carpenters will be building the stage, and we all sort of come together in the morning, you know, have a little meeting and make sure that we're all on the same page. You know, our production manager, Chris Secour, will be orchestrating the plan and making sure everyone's in their respective places, and the doors of the truck will open and equipment will start flying out, and I'm standing where front of house will be set up waiting to receive it. And I'll have a couple of stagehands that'll help me set up my mixing console. And I have a systems tech as well that's helping. He'll help plug stuff in and run the snake for me, you know, and just generally make sure that I'm good to go. And if I need assistance with tuning the PA or anything, he'll throw an extra set of ears or, you know, just help me solve a problem that I encounter. And then we'll do our line check with the crew typically. I'll start off listening to what we call virtual sound check, which is basically a multi-track recording of the previous night's show. So you can play it back through the mixing console and listen to exactly how the band sounds through the speaker system and get it balanced in the room. So I can do that before I listen to the actual instruments to get everything balanced. And that way, by the time I turn on the instruments and listen to them, I'm already pretty much there, you know, and I can experiment and refine the tones with playing it back with a DAW for virtual sound check in a way that would be sort of difficult if I had the crew up there. I couldn't just ask them to hit the fourth and fifth tom over and over for 9 minutes while I experiment with EQ or something, you know. So virtual sound check is a really big part of the day, you know, making sure that everything's balanced, you know, and when I do that, I can walk around and listen to the PA and make sure that it feels good in the different parts of the room. And the systems tech that I'm working with will help me get that balanced out and make sure that the room just sounds the same everywhere. Yeah. So working hand in hand with the systems tech is really important, you know, the audio systems tech, that is. They're like your extra set of ears and your extra brain, basically, you know, because there's, with some of these shows, there's a lot of zones of PA that you have to balance. I'm giving a stereo mix out of the console, essentially, you know, but sometimes it has to go to mono front fills and it has to go to a bathroom feed. And I have to send like just a vocal group with just vocals to the sign language interpreter for the hearing impaired. The main PA, you know, which might have side hangs and the main left and rights, and you might have delays. So there's all these places that you have to make that stereo and mono once you get your mix balanced. And getting the mix to translate in all of these different rooms is an interesting challenge too, because you have to find a lot of happy mediums. We're playing big arenas, which are echoey. They were designed for ice hockey and basketball and stuff, and they want to make the fans, like, if you clap, it sounds like 10 people clapping. So if he hits a snare, it sounds like 10 people hitting a snare. You have to tame and work around all of those reflections and echoes and stuff. If you're in a festival in a big outdoor field, there's no reflections, but now you notice, oh my gosh, it's so dry, you know, there's no reverb or anything. Because like in big arenas, you know, like reverb on the drums and things like that, there's a lot of natural reverb there in addition to whatever effects reverb you might add for tonal character or vibe of the song. But you have to deal with this extra just with everything, you know?
Right. And it's also a big difference between an empty arena versus one that's full.
Yeah. You know, in the summertime versus the wintertime, for example, in the wintertime, everyone brings their jackets. So you have 10, 20,000 people that are all carrying a big fluffy jacket into this environment versus 10, 20,000 people that are all wearing sleeveless t-shirts or whatever. Sound can reflect off of any surface. You know, the harder the surface, the more the reflection, but skin is still a surface. If you have enough skin around a venue, that'll cause reflections. Heat, humidity, all of those things affect how it sounds after doors open. In a hockey arena, it's freezing all day long when you're tuning the PA and setting everything. But then you have an audience come in and you have the first two bands go.
Things,
you know, you got an hour
up,
of people rocking and partying, and now it's a humid, sweaty mess. You know, so the high frequencies travel differently. So, you know, and that's one of the things where, you know, as the mixer, I don't really deal with that as much, other than notice if there's no high end. But the systems tech, that's where they come into play, or one of the places they come into play during the show, is making sure that they compensate for any humidity changes and temperature changes, you know, in the processor of the speaker system, you know, which all the modern brands of PA basically have those capabilities. You know.
Well, that's a good point. You've mentioned a few things in there I want to touch on. One, you've mentioned the stagehands and the system tech. Are those people that are on your staff, or they come in with each individual venue?
The stagehands are provided locally. So there's a team, like in our case, I think we use, like when we just have the festival production, I think we use 32 stagehands or something like that. You know, we have four trucks. When we play a tour and we're carrying full PA and full lights, we have more stagehands than that. But, you know, those are provided locally. And our production manager and stage manager as a team determine how many we need for the event to pull off what we have to pull off. And they'll plan that with the local promoter. So we get there, and, you know, for my purposes as the sound mixer, there'll be four guys that the stage manager sends to front of house. Those are my audio guys, you know, so they'll help us pull the snake and tip the consoles and stuff like that. And there are four other guys that are local audio team guys that are sent to the stage to help the monitor engineer set up his world. Each of our teams have a team of locals to help them. And, the systems technician, like the audio systems technician, travels with us. In our case, we have three audio techs with us, a monitor systems tech, an audio systems tech, and then just a general sound system technician. They're an essential part of our team or piece of the puzzle, you know, and like my front of house systems tech, he'll get with the local systems technician if we're playing a festival, for example, who will be responsible for the overall festival, because every band that's there is playing through the same speaker system, but we all bring our own, you know, I think it's called a control system now when you bring your own consoles and such. Yeah, so we'll bring our own control, and the systems technician for the festival's PA system, they will hopefully have the PA tuned nicely and deployed nicely and everything will be functioning. But our job is to sort of double check and make sure that they've actually paid attention, or that no surprise problems happen. Sometimes it's a 3-day festival and we're headlining the last act of the last day. You know, band number 3 on day 2 could have just clipped the shit out of everything and, damaged some equipment or something, and now I'm suffering for it. So I want to know about that when we're setting up and testing the PA so that I can make it as good as it can be, at least.
Work around.
You
know,
sometimes you have to work with reality. It just sucks, but you can make it better than it was, at least. And that, I think that's a, just a, on a random thought of just sound engineering is, you know, sometimes it can't be whatever this ideal in your head is, but you have to accept what the reality is of the situation. Like we played in Montreal on this last run in a stadium. It was built for the 1980 Olympics.
Oh yeah. Right?
And has nothing to do with music production or entertainment production. You know, the design of this building, and it has the longest echo I've ever heard in any stadium that I've ever mixed in. It was insane, just insane, you know, but what can I do to make it more comfortable at our show than at the last show that was there, even though it's going to suck because there's just this horrible echo and there's boominess and there's stuff bouncing everywhere. But like, maybe I can make it so it's not painful, or maybe I can reduce the low end so it doesn't boom as much or whatever, you know? So just you got to make it as good as you can.
Do you run into that type of challenge a lot?
Yeah. I mean, that's big outdoor festivals are the best because they're just in open fields generally. So they sound great. And when you play the amphitheaters and the stadiums and the arenas, which are where most popular bands play, the acoustics are just not good. Like amphitheaters, they were designed for concerts, but ultimately they're a big metal roof that you're blowing speakers at. They're going to echo. That's something that you have to learn how to deal with and learn what you can affect and what you just can't affect change in. There's some reflections that you simply cannot get rid of. You have to embrace. And there's other reflections with a modification of how you have the PA tuned. You can get rid of it by pointing the PA in a different direction or by electronically modifying it somehow.
I think that's pretty cool, the fact that you get these system techs with you. I mean, you're a large enough tour and you're going around with your own system tech, which is not a luxury that a lot of people have.
It's a huge luxury.
Yeah. So for you to be able to have that and make these adjustments and have the right gear to monitor it and everything is a great deal. But what I want to go back to is the stagehands that come with the local area, usually union stagehands in a lot of cases. But have you ever run into issues with them not working up to par, not meeting your expectations?
Sure. But you have to understand, I think you have to assess where the expectations should be. Like after the pandemic, for example, the industry lost so many seasoned stagehands who for year after year were like, they have other jobs and careers for their life, livelihood, but their hobby and the thing they love to do was be a stagehand at the local arena or whatever. You know, a lot of those people retired, you know, cause they couldn't work for a year and a half due to the pandemic. And then we got all these new people who have never done a show before. They just need work. So the way I look at it is it's our job as touring people to train those people to be the best they can be. I'll get people that have never undone a latch on a case before, or they don't understand, okay, we're going to tip this thing on its side and undo the latches and lift this cap off, and then we're going to lift this thing and put it on this other thing. You know, like whereas a seasoned stagehand, they've done that 1,000 times. You don't have to explain to them you take the latch, you pull the butterfly out, you turn it to the left. You know, they already know this basic thing. You know, so I've seen touring people can sometimes get frustrated with that. And it can be frustrating because you have a lot of pressure on you. You have a short amount of time to do a lot of things. I brought my A game. Why didn't they? Well, we have to bring them up to the A game. We have to train them to be awesome. And you know, you can't speak to any of them like they're lower than you in any way, you know, no matter how little understanding they have of whatever the task at hand is, you have to be kind, you know, and a lot of times when you kindly, like when I can see this group of stagehands has no idea what's going on, I'll be like, hey guys, come here for a second. We'll just do a little, you know, lesson on a couple of things. Watch how I fold this cable. See how I tape the E-tape around it. Okay. So make it all that, you know, you just give them a little instruction with a smile, you know, and they're like, oh, okay, let me try that. And you know, now they're proud because they can do it exactly right. Or they learned how to do a figure eight coil on the snake or whatever it is. And I think that it's important to teach the people around you at these shows that just they're not as skilled and experienced. They don't know as much, and their problem solving skills are not there. They don't know what to do. So it's our job to, as touring people, whether we like it or not, I think, to make them know what to do by helping them.
Well, we should always want to help everybody anyway, especially when I worked in the education field and then worked out in the studios. And we should always want to help the people who are coming up behind us, because they're gonna be our coworkers in the near future. Mm-hmm. The challenge with that, though, is you're running into every day, you've got a different crew of stagehands, so you got to rely on the next band that's coming through town to work with them as well.
Mm-hmm. The more artists in a row that are kind and teach the locals what they know and what's expected, what's useful and helpful to this project, the better off it's going to be for everyone. Because, you know, like if four tours in a row do that to this local team, now that local team's probably going to be pretty good.
Right. Yeah. And they're going to learn different styles from different people, because you're going to do something one way and somebody else might do it another. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, there's a general set of things that people do the same. But one thing you just mentioned in there was problem solving. And I know in the studio, we have to work fast. Everything is mm-hmm. fast. Time is money and we have to move. But I can only imagine that might amplify out in a live scenario, especially if the band is currently on stage whenever the issue arise. So what kind of troubleshooting issues have you come across when the band is on stage?
I mean, at this point, we have very few technical problems ever, because we have the means to be prepared. You know, we have the best companies and the best staff. Stuff generally doesn't go bad, but on occasion, you have an incident where somebody just makes a mistake or doesn't, you know, they just make a mistake. They fail at their job and you just have to deal with it. You know, you have to be calm and make sure that, don't let anybody see your emotions, come up with a plan, bring people together, tell them what the plan is. So, you know, everyone's on the same page and just go. RF can be a challenge. I've seen people grind to a halt due to RF issues. We have an RF coordinator. One of our audio technicians, part of his job is to coordinate the radio frequencies for all of our in-ear monitors, for all the guitarists' belt packs for their wireless systems, and for the singer's handheld mic. Each of those have a frequency that they're broadcast on. And if you're not responsible and you don't use legal frequencies and you don't coordinate it and plan to make sure that other people aren't going to be broadcasting on those frequencies, it could be a nightmare. So I've seen people where you're at a festival and you have three stages and they're all interchanging and you're getting ready to go on to do your show, and then somebody on two stages over flips on their wireless stuff, and all of a sudden you have somebody going jank jank with their guitar right through your rig in front of your show. So things like that can happen periodically. One of the ways that we avoid that is that we, like for a Europe tour, you have to license all of your frequencies for each place you're going to go. So we buy the frequencies that we're going to use. So if someone were broadcasting on those frequencies, they're committing a crime, for example, you know, and you can call the authorities on them, and especially in Germany, you know, they're really sensitive about there. But, yeah, so in America, there's still plenty of rules with the FCC, and I would encourage anybody that's interested in mixing monitors or being audio technician to learn as much as they can about radio frequencies and radio equipment and FCC rules and such, because that's a skill that's pretty complex and really important to all the big tours out there. Everybody uses a lot of channels of wireless, and if you don't have it coordinated well, it will affect your show. And, you know, speaking of like affecting the show, you know, I have another luxury I have with Five Finger Death Punch situation is I have a main mixing console, you know, which, you know, is a Midas HD96 in this case. And I have a switcher that I can push a little button, and now I'm on the spare mixing console. So if anything goes wrong with anywhere in the chain of the Midas or Avid or whichever brand I happen to be using, I hit this button and now I'm on a whole separate console. Maybe the audience might have heard a momentary glitch, but as far as the audience knows, oh, there was some random momentary glitch, but we're rocking again. And the band doesn't even know, wouldn't even know. And that gives me a lot of comfort, just having that ability. Most artists, I think, if anything goes wrong with their console, if they have to stop and reboot or whatever, everyone in the room's just standing there wondering what's going on.
Right.
Why is there silence? Why'd the band walk off the stage? Or with some artists, that can cause, you know, they don't want to deal with technical difficulties or wait for your issues. They've paid you to make sure there's no issues, you know? So you have to figure out creative ways of making sure there's no issues. That's one thing that I've been lucky enough to have with Five Finger Death Punch also is the ability to have a spare console. So if I don't have to worry if something goes wrong. I changed brands of mixing console for this tour cycle from the last tour cycle. If I didn't have the spare console to fall back on, I wouldn't feel quite as confident just making a change. Yeah. But it's like, if anything goes wrong, if there's a new glitch that I'm not familiar with, because all of these mixing consoles these days are computers will have glitches, they'll crash. So you have to be prepared.
Right. And that could definitely kill the mood of a show. But
oh yeah,
when you're talking about making a switch to a spare console, and like you just said, there are digital consoles these days. Does that mean that your spare console is got memory settings from your other console? I mean, how do you make a change like that on the fly?
In this case, it's a different brand. So it's a whole separate mix. So I could do a mix on one or I could do a mix on the other. So I have to do a little line check, sound check on the B console, I call it. Yeah. I have to do a little bit of a, you know, just make sure it still sounds good every day, you know, and make sure that it's still, everything's right in it.
So you're getting rough levels and settings during the sound check.
I mean, I make a mix that's, because every console is going to have its own sort of characteristic and you're going to do things a little bit different anyways. So I do what's good on that console to make it sound as good as possible and do what's good on the main console to make it sound as good as possible. And if I have them both going, for example, I, you know, mute the guitars on one and mute the guitars on the other, I can go back and forth between them and see if they have the same character and feel and level and just clarity and whatever. Yeah. So that's the thing, is I want the feel to be the same, even though the sound will be slightly different because it's different equipment, different consoles, different processing and whatever.
Not enough that the audience is going to be able to tell.
Yeah. You know, maybe another sound engineer, like, you know, that's listening out there might hear it. Oh, this is a different plugin or something, right. But nobody cares.
Even they don't know. How instantaneous is that switch?
Instantaneous. As a matter of fact, I keep them both on during the show. So the spare console, I just have to turn up the master bus. So I keep the master bus down. I just reach over and it's like literally right next to me, you know, so I just reach it and push the button. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I like that. So how would you describe your mixing style?
I try to capture what the band is doing and make it awesome for the audience, make an awesome experience for the audience where they hear their the song that they listen to in the car on the way to work or whatever, they crank or whatever, whatever the circumstance that they know the song from, I want that to just make them rock out. In this case, working with a heavy metal band, that's what I want it to be comfortable. I want it to be like loud and clear, but never painful. Making sure that you know the band's music as much as possible is important. Like, I've been with this band for, 14 years now. I still listen to their records. I'm home from tour right now, and we start up, we fly in a couple weeks. I have a playlist on my iPhone, and I'm constantly going through the set. I have a mixing console. I have a Midas HD 96 mixing console here at home, so I can do virtual sound check through the studio speakers, and so I'll sit down and I'll mix the show as if I'm mixing the show. Every couple of days I'll run through the set several times, and then on the other days I'll experiment and just try different things. So I think it's important to try different things and not get stuck in a rut. Try different consoles or try different methods or settings or whatever. Go outside of your box a little bit. Because there's certain things you're going to come back to a certain extent. Like, I call it my template or whatever. A lot of engineers have a way they'll set up the console. So you'll have certain things that are constant. Like, the way I group things is almost a constant, but the way I process muscle those groups memory can be different from tour to tour or whatever. Like, I'll find a way that works better, but if I keep that basic template, I know where everything's at from muscle memory, like you said, and just have a plan. If you're just starting with a band, get as much information as you can about their equipment. Get lyric sheets for all of their songs, and as you're listening to their songs, write little notes like, how'd that snare drum thing happen there? Oh, there was a guitar solo here, but that sounded like a third guitar, but they only have two guitar players. So what's going to happen there? So, you have to learn the arrangements and learn how to compensate for the things that they... Well, you're never going to reproduce what the album is live, but you want to get some of the main character of the albums as close as you can. Like, one of the things that I'll look for is that my high end and my low end are in my mix is sort of similar to the high end and low end in the studio albums that Kane and Kevin Turco made. Their mixes are excellent, and I'll use them as a reference. So when I'm listening, and this is really humbling too, I'll be listening to, some experimenting that I'm doing on the console, and then I'll hit the little button that pops it over to the actual CD and be like, oh, nope, delete, gotta start over from scratch. That's horrible. And then every now and then, you through enough experimenting and trying different methods, you'll get it to where it's this similar character. So just trying to capture the character of the band, I think, is an important part of being a sound mixer. A useful part of being a sound mixer, because the band are what they are, and a lot of people try to change the band, to fit their signature mixing style or whatever. I think your mixing style should change to fit the band instead. And I've mixed a lot of bands over the years, but I've been fortunate with some of the main ones to be with them for a long time. Like, Static X is another artist that I mixed, and I was with them for a decade. And you really get to know the intricacies of the songs and the little details, and you can see if somebody has a technical problem, say they broke a string or something, I can compensate for that by maybe hiding them a little bit while they're sorting out their problem, instead of accenting them at that moment or whatever. Working with the vocalists, making sure that their harmonies are good. We have 3 to 4 singers at any time with Five Finger Death Punch. So there's a lot going on with the vocals, and sometimes the background singers will take over a line that the lead singer is singing while the lead singer is pointing his mic at the audience or something like that. You know, so just making sure all the balances are there and the communication's there with the artist, so you know what they're going to do, so it's not a surprise to you. You're not chasing it. So making notes, you know, having a plan.
A few of the things, I mean, you're laying out some really good stuff, so I want to make sure we don't miss any of it. So I'm trying to take notes as fast as you're talking. One of the things you mentioned was technology, and you have the ability to have a console in your house, and you can do some mixes from the stuff that you've captured out in the stadiums or in the tour. So what are some other pieces of technology that have come along that you're trying to woodshed, and how much of your time do you spend woodshedding?
I spend a lot of time, I call it studying or practicing is what I call it, but I spend a lot of time every day almost. Like there's a couple of days where I won't do anything or read anything or whatever, but every day. It can be things as mundane as figuring out how the harmonics on different processors affect the tonalities of and blend of your mix, or learning how to use smart software in different ways for different purposes, you know, and that's one of the essential technologies for me actually as a sound mixer is smart, which is it's a RTA, basically a system, a frequency measurement and a time measurement software.
Real-time analyzer.
So I can take a signal from the console, and I can take a signal that's measured from a mic out of a speaker, yeah? And I can compare those two things. So we have the, like say I'm running pink noise out of the console, I can see that the line is perfectly flat. And then I run pink noise out of the console to smart. I mean, I can see that it's perfectly flat. And then I'll run it through the PA, and I'll see that the lines are all jaggly and, you know.
Right.
Peaks and valleys, right? So I can balance it out. That's the software that the majority of systems technicians will use to optimize their speaker system. Some people use, you know, different things, and some people just use their ears. But I think that smart is a wonderful sort of balance to check what your ears and your brain are thinking. Because sometimes your ears and your brain fill things in that aren't there based on what your eyes see in a way, you know, there's psychoacoustic things that you can get fooled by, and smart sometimes helps you go, nope, that's empirical. That's right there. But at the same time, it can lead you down a rabbit hole of chasing your tail and just making your problems worse if you rely on it too much without balancing what your ear tells you.
Oh, absolutely. That's the same system we use in the studio to tune the rooms that we mix in. Mm-hmm. One of the other things you mentioned was referencing the CD. And I mm-hmm. know you've had the opportunity to record some tracks for live CDs. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me what the difference might be for you, or how you would approach recording a live show and what you do differently?
We record every show, and we've released one live album. Kane Turco mixed it and I recorded it. I think it's basically the same. You have to make sure that you capture, like your drums, for example, in our case, there's a lot of live mics. Our guitars and such and bass are all direct signals, so there's no bleed through to worry about, right? The guitar only has guitar in it. You know? But the snare drum, for example, in our case, has the lead singer's vocal in it, because right. there's a monitor aiming right at with the lead singer singing. You know, and so I have to reduce it as much as I can without negatively affecting the sound of the drone. The band all wear in-ear monitors except for the singer. The singer, the way he performs, he needs to interact with the room. He needs to, when an audience member screams something to him, he needs to directly be able to communicate with them. Those little cues are what guide his show and his performance in a way, you know? So just in-ear monitors would not work for him. For the rest of the band, they use in-ear monitors and no wedges. Like the drummer has no speakers around him. It's the singer's speakers that are near the drum kit with the singer's vocal going through them. We're supporting Metallica on their world tour, which is an amazing experience. And the stage is this huge donut that goes all the way across a football field. Like, it's massive. And normally we have 14 monitor wedges for our stage, and that's overkill. Covers everything. It's louder than you could want it to be everywhere, you know? And in this case, we have 32 wedges around the stage because the stage is so big. Needless to say, in a big echoey stadium, having that many wedges creates more echo and ambience because you can hear it no matter where you are in the room, you know? But yeah, we have a lot of speakers on stage.
What do you feel makes a good solid mix in a stadium?
You can hear everything. Nothing is painful. The vocals are above the music, and you can hear every single word that not just the lead singer says, but the background singers. When they're talking in between songs, that might even be when the vocal mix is the most important. I mean, not most, I'm being silly a little bit, but when the artist is talking to their audience, a lot of times people sort of say it and forget it and, you know, and whatever. But to me, my hand's on that fader in between songs, you know, and making sure that they can hear everything he utters, whether it's loud or soft. If he talks loud, I don't want it to be painful. So I make sure that I tuck him a little bit. And if he's talking soft and intimate, I want to make sure that that's like right in you, especially if he's telling some inspirational story to somebody out in the audience that's suffering some emotional experience, you know, and you want it to really be dramatic for them, you know.
Well, how do you get that clarity though?
Making sure that the PA is well tuned. Running pink noise, for example, if you take a measurement, you want no peaks and valleys in it. You know, you want a linear response from the highest frequency the PA will produce to the lowest frequency. And then somewhere in the low end, you'll have what some people might call a tilt. You know, so maybe in the low end, starting around 200 hertz, it starts to tilt up. And by the time you get to 40 hertz, it's at like plus 6 or plus 9 or something, just to give you impact and excitement. That's just making sure that there's clarity and coverage and no pain is one thing that I always come back to. Like, there should be no pain. Like, you think of a typical hockey arena venue people play at. Some of the most important people at the show, like the band's friends, management, other artists, they're going to stand right in front of the PA, essentially, because they're going to walk out next to the dashers in the hockey arena, you know, and lean on it right by the barricade, right where the big pile of subs are, right where this front fill is. It's blasting you in the face if you don't control it. So you have to make sure that all of those zones, and just make sure it's comfortable. Comfortable and no pain are reoccurring themes, I think, with mixing.
Give us an example of something that could cause pain.
A harsh guitar, like a guitar that's just bright. Like Zoltan, the leader of Five Finger Death Punch, one of the things that he asked me when I first started working with them is, well, he let me know that he doesn't like super bright, fuzzy guitars. You know, he wants them to be, you know, they have high end, but it's very tamed. And, you know, the low end and the mids are really where his guitar is accented, you know?
Well, on that note, sir, we do this thing here we call Unsung Heroes, where we take a moment to shine the light on somebody who's worked behind the scenes or somebody who supports you in some sort of way. Do you have anybody you would like to shine a little light on?
Stepan Buzan. He's our audio tech for our upcoming Europe tour. He's one of the audio team. He's a wonderful guy. So I'd love to shine a light on him for his knowledge and abilities in figuring out complicated setups.
A big thanks to Bruce for taking the time to share his stories with us, and thank you for taking the time to hang with me here. As always, I really do appreciate it. If you know another music fan that would enjoy this episode, please be sure to pass it along. You can do that and find the links to everything mentioned over at jfranzi.com/episode67. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Jay Franzi Show. Make sure you visit us at jfranzi.com. Follow, connect, and say hello. This episode has been brought to you by VR Knives, your source for 100% custom knives made by a true rock star. So, if you're in the market for a new piece of art, reach out to VR Knives. 407-421-5528. 407-421-5528.